Yeah, that's a really powerful question.
Beautiful question.
That's a great question.
Lauren.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. The Right Question is supported by members of Montana Public Radio and by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, speaking with Irish novelist Kevin Barry, author of The Heart in Winter, a novel following young lovers Tom Rourke and Polly Gillespie in Butte, Montana in the 1890s. The Guardian called The Heart in Winter, quote, a wedding of Cormac McCarthy with Flann O'Brien, a Western, but also the most Irish of novels. Anne Enright called it an absolute belter of a book. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to The Right Question.
Thank you, Lauren. It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
We're here to talk about your novel, The Heart in Winter. You begin the book with an epigraph from the writer Mary MacLean. She writes, I do not see any beauty in self-restraint. Tell me, Kevin, how you came to Mary MacLean as a reader and why this particular line spoke to you and why you feel it speaks to this particular novel.
Yeah, Mary MacLean, I was researching Butte, Montana as a very young man in 1999 when I was 29 years old. I had the idea for this novel. It was the first novel that I attempted, actually. I visited Butte at that time. That was my research trip. It was in October 99. And I got lots of great material for a novel, lots of material about the Irish migration to the city in the 1890s when it was a big copper mining camp. I wrote about 120,000 words at that time, but the novel never took for me. It never came to life. And I think one of the things that put me off was I discovered Mary MacLean and I started to read her. And she's so good. She's such a phenomenal voice. And she's like, there has been a various couple of resurgences in interest in her over the years. And her books have been reissued, I think, by New York Review Press or something at one point. But she's amazing, and I'm always pushing her onto people. You know, you've got to read Mary MacLean. But that particular line, I do not see any beauty in self-restraint, it had always stuck with me. And this is a story of two lovers, Tom and Polly, and they have no self-restraint, none whatsoever. They're just caught up in this thing and they have to go with it. And it's a devil-may-care kind of attitude they have to the world around them, and they can only go with their own kind of thunderbolt romance when it takes off back in the old Butte, Montana. And I guess it's also a comment on my prose style. I sometimes think I'd love a really pared, flipped back, austere prose style, but it's just not in me. You know, I'd like to write in the high style, to really go for it at the sentence level and to see what I can do with the sentences. So that Mary MacLean line appealed, I guess, on two levels to me.
Yeah. I want to talk about your prose, but first you mentioned that The Heart in Winter was your first attempt at a novel. It's obviously not the first novel that you published, but in now your bibliography, this novel is your first set in America, right? It's set, as you said, in Butte, Montana in the 1890s. Listeners and readers familiar with Butte will find a lot to love in this book, mentions of the Orphan Girl Mine and the M&M Bar. You call Butte the Black Heart City. Is the Butte that you're writing about a Butte that you acquainted yourself with in real life, or is it hyper-fictional? Is it really born of the Western myths that come out of Montana? Tell me about that relationship for you.
Yeah, like a whole stew of the elements you've mentioned there, for sure. I literally fell into a hole in the ground with this novel in 1999. Like, as I mentioned, I was 29 and I was working as a freelance journalist in Cork City in Ireland. And I had one of those classic 29-year-old good hard conversations with myself. I said, young man, it's time to attend to your prose, you know? It's time to write the novel. So I wrote lots of newspaper features and stuff, and I saved up money, and I had 3 months. I had enough money for 3 months, and I went to the coast of County Cork, a place called the Beara Peninsula, and I was trying to write a novel, and I had nothing. I had no idea what I was going to write a novel about. And I was walking in the mountains there one day, and I came across these old abandoned copper mines. And I thought, okay, that's interesting. And I started to research about them. And I learned that they'd played out. The mines had played out in the 1880s, and all the miners en masse had left Ireland and gone to Butte, Montana, because America was being electrified. Butte was suddenly a copper rush town. There were a lot of jobs. There was money to be made, and they all went out there. And I started to research it a little further, and I was amazed by the extent of it. In 1891, there were 30,000 people in Butte, and 10,000 of them were from County Cork.
Wow.
In Ireland. And I thought to myself, it's a Western, but it's got County Cork accents. I'm in, you know, this. I can do this Western. So at that point, I said, I've got to go to Butte. And it was my first trip to the US. I flew to Seattle and got on a Greyhound bus for about 14 hours with every glorious maniac in the Pacific Northwest on the bus out to Montana. I had a ball, and I got to Butte, and I had a really great time. I mean, it was Butte, as people will know, is very proud of its Irish heritage. And when you show up in the place with an actual Irish accent, you are very quickly embraced to the bosom of the town. And people were so kind to me, you know. This guy who had never published a word of fiction, just showing up saying, look, I'm writing a novel about this place. What have you got for me? You
know? Wow.
And I got loads. I got so much material. I remember in the library there, they were like bringing out box loads of letters that they had that miners had written back to Ireland in the 1890s. I had all this great material about the brothels and the bars and the opium parlors back in that kind of 1890s heyday when it was this little sin city high in the Rockies. And I knew it was great material for a novel, but I guess I didn't know how to reduce the material yet.
Okay, so that was in the late 90s. Why return to the novel, or what was the impetus to your return to the novel now? How many, you know, nearly 30 years, over 30 years later?
What happened was I went back to Ireland after Butte, and I wrote this 120,000 words that was like, it was kind of, I didn't have the characters was what it was. I had great atmosphere. I had great kind of detail and texture for a novel, but I didn't have the people yet. And I kind of forgot about it, and I kind of poignantly pushed it to one side. And I wrote 6 other books. And suddenly we were in the second year of the pandemic in 2021. And I knew I was due to write a new novel. And I was walking here in the forest one day in County Sligo, where I live now in the northwest of Ireland. And I thought to myself, you know what, if you're in the woods, you're in a Western. All you need is a little bit of imagination. And I just saw them. I saw my characters, Tom and Polly, and this was a couple riding double on a horse. And I thought, if they're riding double, they're on the run. They need to get out of town quick. And I knew them. I had it in a fell swoop. Tom and Polly, runaway lovers, and they're on their way out of Butte, Montana in 1891. And what followed, I wrote the novel in about 10 months that followed that. And it was probably the happiest experience I've had in my writing life. These characters just kind of took it up for me and galloped down the road with it, you know?
Yeah. I want to come back to maybe the guidelines that you use when you're writing history, but let's talk a little bit more about your prose, I guess. The Guardian said of this novel that it, quote, walks the line between goofy and gothic. And an interviewer for The Believer magazine once said about your prose more generally that it holds a, quote, savage and comic lyricism. And A Heart in Winter has been called hazy and boozy, written as if from behind a screen of smoke. These are from booksellers who have read your work. Another called it dreamy. And I'm wondering, Kevin, as a lyricist, as a stylist, how did you come to what is a really delicate combination of tone and voice and language? Like, how did you find the haze of this novel? I think you've talked a little bit about it here today. Can you dive a little bit more into that?
Yeah, I mean, One thing I guess experience in writing fiction gives you is, and I've been writing fiction full time for more than 20 years now, you become a little bit more economical with your time. So I won't give something 6 months to see if I can make a novel out of it. I'll give it 2 weeks. And my plan when I came up with Tom and Polly was, okay, I'm going to try him for a week. And then I'm going to try her for a week and see how that goes. So the first week I tried to write Tom Rourke, this 29-year-old Irishman in Butte, who's kind of a poet, kind of a ballad maker. He's a disaster of a young man. He's a doper. He's a drinker. He's a general ne'er-do-well. But he's also a young person of literary ambition. That's what he is. And I kind of knew what that felt like, you know? And I thought, okay. And I wrote him for a week. And it's much as it is in that first chapter in the book where he's on this kind of crawl around Butte one night going from bar to dope house to brothel and back again and getting into all sorts of trouble. And I thought it felt, I'm getting the world building in without it seeming too forced. My second week on the novel, I was more nervous because I was going to try Polly. And Polly is an American voice. She's a young woman who's arrived from Chicago to marry somebody else in an arranged marriage. But I was at my desk for about 20 minutes that second Monday morning. And I said to myself, I have a novel. I have it. Her voice was just there for me. And I knew she was going to earth the novel. She was going to give it a kind of a calm, quiet center, which it needed, because Tom Rourke is not a quiet, calm presence in any kind of way. He's very unsure who he is. He's trying to find out who he is in the world.
Yeah.
He's trying on all kind of styles and aspects. Polly knows exactly who she is. And she has a confidence in herself and a kind of a certainty. And in that horrible modern phrase, the two kind of complete each other. And it works as a romance, I think. But the language is influenced. Tom, I felt on steady ground with, if that's the word for this particular character, because I know what it's like to be a young 29-year-old Irishman of literary ambition. It's an exalted position to find yourself in, and it's also routinely a catastrophe. Okay. with Polly, I would have to say there is a very strong influence on Polly's voice, and it comes from two Terrence Malick movies that I loved from the 1970s, Badlands and Days of Heaven. Days of Heaven especially, he uses two great female voiceovers in those films by Sissy Spacek and by Linda Manse. And they're beautiful, poetic, kind of a blankly poetic voice that he manages for these. I don't think they were ever actually written. They were kind of improvised by the actors working with Terrence Malick. And I thought, that's Polly. That there's that tone or note that I wanted to get into it. And I even went as far as kind of transcribing some of the Linda Mann's voiceover from Days of Heaven and typing it out and putting it above my desk and using it as a kind of a tuning fork for her, you know? But it's like, it's weird, Lauren. I think the writing fiction is a strange and esoteric business, and it's hard to use a flippant phrase like the trick of it when it comes to writing fiction. But the trick of it is to find a story that's right for your desk at a particular time in your life. Timing. And I knew as soon as I started to write Polly Gillespie, this is the right time for me to write this novel. I have it now. I have this character. And she really held it for me. I felt as I was bringing it together.
You're listening to A Conversation with Kevin Barry. I'm Lauren Korn. This episode of The Right Question is supported by Bookworks of Whitefish, offering new books of all genres, stationery, and puzzles. Open 11 to 6, Monday through Saturday. Located in downtown Whitefish in the 3rd and Spokane building. You said Tom Rourke, he's this Irish poet. He's also a matchmaker of sorts. He writes letters from other men in Butte to women elsewhere, trying to get them to come overseas.
This was an actual job that would have existed in Butte at the time. A lot of the Irish miners that came over, a lot weren't very literate, wouldn't have had good writing skills. And some just wouldn't have had a confidence about writing to young women. You know, where Tom is kind of silver-toned. You know, he has a way with words, and he can do that. But those kind of jobs existed in the city.
What I found really interesting about Tom's character, one of the many interesting things about Tom's character, was that he expresses a lot of disdain for, as you said earlier, the many, many thousands of Irish immigrants in Butte at that time. You've written that, quote, he was dissatisfied with the ambiance, too many Irish. There were by now 10,000 Hibernian to the town, and they had the place f***ing destroyed. And then he hated to be wistful for home. He hated the sentimental singing through the streets. So, Kevin, talk me through that decision. Why make Tom so scornful of where he comes from?
He's the classic sniffy young artist outsider. And to be that person, you have to see yourself as apart from your fellows at an obtuse angle to the crowd. Every young artist and every young writer has felt this at some point. You know, I'm elevated from this common mass by my artistic ability and by my artistic ambition. He has this entirely unearned confidence in his own abilities, and that's what you need if you're go of something as unlikely in life as poetry or ballad making or whatever your creative pursuit is. So for sure, I mean, I wouldn't say it's quite autofiction and it's not quite memoir, but he's an exaggerated, heightened version of the way I was in my late 20s for sure. But it's kind of, I think he's good-hearted, you know. I think that there is redeeming qualities in his kind of otherwise dissolute character. He likes to see others do okay. He likes it when it works out and when someone agrees to marry one of these minors he's written a letter for. And brave women would do so. In reality, back in the day, these ladies would arrive in from the east and marry these guys straight off the train.
Yeah.
And it was going to go one way or other. Often it went well. Other times it didn't go so well. The thing about it was, though, the miners were making good money. You know, they were making about $7 or $8 a day, which was terrific money for the time. And a lot of the women they were writing to were also Irish immigrants working in like domestic service in Boston or Chicago. And the thing was, come out here, marry me, you'll have a house. You know, it was basic raw commerce. And the Irish have always been economic migrants. You know, we almost invented it as a thing, economic refugees. And it was nice to write this story at this time to remind ourselves, a time in Ireland now when we've got a lot of immigration into the country and a lot of kind of racial tensions because of that. It's important to remember the hypocrisy of that, because we've always gone all over the world looking for work, and they've always been good at it. We're quite personable, and we like to talk. We're these smiling characters, but also quite canny. And if you look at the history of the Irish in Butte, the way they established themselves is very interesting. It followed the model that was used in North America generally. First thing they did, they opened about 38 pubs. You know, that was like the first move.
Yes.
And from there, quickly, they took over the political apparatus of the city, and they took over the police apparatus of the city. And if you go back to Butte a few years after this novel is set, around 10 years later, 1900, it's the complete little Irish machine town, you know? The mix are suddenly running everything. So it's in microcosm, Butte is really interesting in the way of almost being like a little Boston or a little Chicago, the way the Irish organized themselves there.
I love that. Yeah, I love thinking about that. And Butte is still so proud of that Irish history too. It is still, you know, it still has one of the most raucous St. Patrick's Day celebrations probably in the state, country. Very, very proud city. I said that Tom is disdainful of Ireland or the other Irish immigrants in Butte at this time, but you do write about his yearning for the sea. So there is always two sides to that, like home-shaped coin or home-shaped hole in your heart, I guess. He says to Polly at one point that I wasn't right in myself in Butte on account of the no sea. You know, I think that speaks to, I think, the sentimentality. And even in that quote I quoted back to you, you write about the sentimental. You've written and talked a lot about your own fear of sentimentality in your writing, Kevin. How has that dictated the direction of your work, and maybe this novel in particular, but maybe more broadly, your work as a whole too?
I think whatever you're afraid of showing up in your fiction, in your stories, you can be absolutely assured that it's very close by. There's a reason you're afraid of it. And I've always been terrified of sentimentality as a thing creeping in. But sentimentality is just feeling, you know? It's just kind of a feeling. And Tom, for all his protestations in the novel, is very sentimental about Ireland and is very sentimental about home. And he misses being by the sea. He misses the sense of being by the Atlantic Ocean. And there's that eternal dilemma that the migrant has, is that after a few years, you're not quite in home in either place. You know, you're not at home if you go back to the old country, or you're not really ever quite at home in the new one either. And you're this kind of, your character is caught between the two in a way that can never quite be solved. And it's great. This is great material for a fiction writer, because it's a tension within people that's never quite there to be fixed, you know, and for sure it's something that animates Tom and his perception of the world. But he is, it was very interesting to set it in 1891, because this is the period when every main street in North America suddenly has a photographic studio opening. And Tom and Polly meet, not uncoincidentally, at a photographic studio for the very first time in human history. Very ordinary working class people are suddenly thinking about their image, and they're thinking about how we look, and they're presenting an image of themselves, and they're trying on styles, and they're trying on airs. Now, the rich and privileged people have been doing this for centuries and having oil paintings made of themselves. But now every ordinary Jane and Joe is suddenly saying, hey, let's get a look together. And Polly is immediately very taken with Tom's look and his clothes. And he loves the way they look together. And they start to fancy themselves as kind of outlaw types. And that was kind of a nice note to bring into it. They're almost like the very original kind of version of the Instagram hipsters, you know. They're at the very start of all this, I think, in some way.
You know, that's so funny. I did not make the connection between photography, but you also have created a character in Tom who is a little bit self-obsessed with that image that you're talking about. He finds mirrors, you know, he really loves looking at himself in mirrors and kind of evaluating how his clothes are hanging. And you, as the author, as this kind of omniscient person who's observing this too, like, you really have focused in on that. And I wouldn't have made that connection, I don't think. I really, really love that. That makes a lot of sense that you're kind of to just say mirroring that idea of photography being so new for the lower class and Tom.
I love the sense, as I kind of researched the period, of the way it is really the birth of our world, of the modern world. You know, the lights are getting switched on, you know, electricity is starting, photography is becoming an affordable option for everybody. And it was kind of, wow, this is kind of where we started, you know?
Yeah.
And it was, I have to tell us about a great guy I met in Butte.
Yeah, please do.
In 1999, I was on my last morning in the city after about a week there or so. And I was going around with this guy, he was involved with kind of an Irish History Society. And he said, by the way, have you met Yank? And I said, who's Yank? And he said, oh my God, come on. You've got to meet Yank Harrington. And Yank Harrington was 99 years old. He had been born in 1900 in Butte,
wow,
to parents from County Cork. And he was still sharp as a tack and living independently. And I went to see him. I was brought down. And he said, okay, listen, I've just had my flu shot, so I might need to have a nap, but we can talk for a little while. And we talked for 4 hours. And he gave me so many amazing stories about Butte in and around 1904, 1905, very close to the period of the novel, when the lights were getting switched on, when the roads were getting laid. And at the end, he took down his violin, his fiddle, and he played me some old Irish airs. And I was saying, what were they listening to back in Butte when your parents came here first in the 1890s? And he played me some airs and reels. And they were in my head all the time, 23 years later, when I was finally managing to write the book. Yank ultimately lived till he was about 103 or 104. So I was thinking about him a lot when I wrote The Art and Winter.
Kevin, it's so funny that you are so fearful of sentimentality in your work, and yet just talking to you, I get the impression that you are actually quite a sentimental person.
Oh, stop. I'm a very sentimental gentleman, for sure, yeah. Quick to tears, as they say. Well, I've always been someone since I was a kid who I am moved by books. I'm moved by books, and I'm moved by fiction, and I'm moved by films, and I'm moved by music. And you have to be that kind of emotional basket case, really, to be any kind of an artist or any kind of a storyteller, you know. You have to have that sort of want for these stories that have real feeling in them. But it's when you're writing love, it's very difficult. When you're writing love stories, you're immediately on swampy ground, you know. It can fall into goo and sentimentality very, very easily, you know, and it's, negotiating that is difficult. But when Tom and Polly, you know, it's a genuine thunderbolt love affair and a kind of a lust affair, and they just have no option. We have to go with this thing and follow this thing wherever it's going to take us. And, you know, it's also a hard life in Butte, Montana in 1891, so you have to take your fun where you can find it. I don't know.
Yeah.
There's a great old saying that the Italians have. It's sex is the poor man's opera. So Tom and Polly are quickly making their own theatrics out in Butte at that time.
You know, I don't think it's giving too much away to say that Polly, who you have already said is a very calm presence to Tom's chaos, she resists a lot of sentimentality at the end of the book, too. And we don't have to give away what happens at the ending. I'm wondering if your refusal to kind of lean into sentimentality in your writing, did that make the ending of the book easier to write for you? Because it could have gone in the other direction. Polly could have leaned very far into sentimentality.
I think what I'm trying to do a lot of the time with any story that I write is I'm trying, I guess, to subvert the reader's expectation. And I knew it was a risk to really change tone for that closing chapter, that closing section. And I knew it was coming, and it was difficult to write because it goes into a much sadder register after we've been through quite a lot of hijinks and everything else that's been going on with them. And it's weird. Like usually with a novel, I have a very strong sense at the start of where it is and who's there, and I have maybe a slightly vaguer sense of where it ends up. I have nothing in the middle, and that's the way I need it to be.
That was Kevin Barry, author of The Heart in Winter, out in paperback from Vintage Books, a Doubleday Knopf imprint of Penguin Random House. To listen to this conversation again, to share it with friends, or to learn more about Kevin, head to mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. This episode was produced by Chris Moyles and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Chris also engineered this episode. The artwork for The Right Question was designed by Molly Russell. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008. And thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.